drives my car. We leave his at the trailer park. At some point, we will need to go back and get it, if it's not stolen in the meantime. I sit beside him in the passenger seat, and my knees feel stiff, because I've been sitting in the same position for hours. I keep thinking about Annie's shoulders and how limp they were, but rigor mortis would have set in by now, and now I'm stiff, and I wish for just a passing, fleeting moment that I could be dead too, with Annie and with Dad, away from all of this pain.
Lexi?
Sam speaks gently, and I turn to look at him. The sky has darkened and heavy rain is falling. I look toward the windshield and watch as the water runs down onto the hood, rivulets of ice-cold water. I think about the coldness in Annie's body. She must be in the refrigerated morgue by now. What would happen if I went and held her hand? Maybe if I held it long enough, I could warm it back up again.
Lexi,
Sam says again. This time I manage to croak out an answer.
Yes. I just wanted to say again, I'm so, so sorry.
Thank you. And I know, I say, and I go back to watching the water run down the window. When we finally get back to the house, Sam parks the car in the garage and undoes his seatbelt, but I don't move.
Sweetheart,
Sam says gently, we need to get Daisy inside. I turn to look at him slowly. I've been vaguely aware of Sam tending to Daisy since he arrived, but I haven't really spared her a thought for hours, other than to obsess over what might happen for her next. What might happen for me next? What kind of aunt does that make me? Am I just her aunt now? Daisy doesn't have a mother anymore. I'm all she has left. I'm the only mother she's ever known, other than those disrupted days with Annie in the hospital.
I didn't even tell Annie I loved her. She rang me and I had the chance and I didn't even think of it.
Come on. Sam prompts again, and he unbuckles my seatbelt for me. I reach for the door handle, but I can't focus long enough to open it. Sam removes Daisy from the car and takes her inside, and then he comes back for me. He opens the door, and he gently hooks my arm over his shoulder, and he leads me out of the garage and to the couch. I lie still, like Annie. I close my eyes and I see her purple lips and her gray face, so I open them again, and I stare up at the stucco ceiling while Sam prepares a bottle for Daisy and tops up her acetaminophen. And then he bathes and dresses her and brings her back to me, clean and swaddled and happy. Annie has robbed me. She has taken my happy ending. And I know that this makes me selfish because it was never my happy ending at all. But I deserved to see her okay again. I deserved another Christmas when we sat beside one another and we ate spaghetti or turkey or whatever else we wanted and we laughed and we were both healthy and fully present. I haven't had one of those for years and God damn it, I deserved it. I deserved for Daisy to watch us interact at that dinner. I deserved for Daisy to be my niece. I deserved to be an aunt who could spoil her silly and then pass her back to her mother to handle all the discipline and hard work. I deserved Annie to be beside me at the altar at my wedding. I deserved to glance at her in her bridesmaid's gown, and I deserved to be jealous of how she outshone me. And now, she will not be there. She will not be at any of the big events in my life, or her daughter's life. If Daisy had any chance of surviving her rocky entry into the world unscathed, I'm sure that this is lost now. She will forever be the daughter of a dead woman, a woman who died of a drug overdose. A deliberate drug overdose? Sam has Daisy tucked in his elbow, but he slides his other arm around me. Just as he did this morning. It feels like a million years ago now.
I remember the moment I saw a shadow at the window. Was that really Annie? Or did I imagine it? Was that my chance to save her? Or was it the phone call? How hard would it have been for me to just agree to meet with her in the first place, instead of rejecting her and leaving her alone? How hard would those three little words have been to squeeze into our last conversation? Love you, Annie. Oh, God. What if she did it on purpose? Lexi, Sam whispers, and my tears surge again. I should have saved her. This isn't your fault. I was supposed to look after her. I should have let her see Daisy today. I should have promised her I'd find a way to help her. I press my face into his chest, and I breathe in his scent. He is the warm blanket around my cold heart. But it is not enough. Nothing will ever be enough to take away the ache in my chest. I share awful phone calls with my mother over the days that follow. Our relationship is just close enough that I'm calling her to make sure she's okay, but distant enough that I'm wary when she picks up the phone. All it will take for me to lose my mind completely will be one thoughtless platitude, and surely she is building up a database of them. Robert would have reacted to the news of Annie's death with some condescending self-righteous commentary, littered with Bible verses and scorn. And Mom is virtually his sidekick. If I hear her say those things, it will be the end of what's left of our relationship. And then, my family will be gone, not just broken, not just chaotic, gone. I'm more scared of this than I should be, given how dysfunctional we've been for the last 20 years. But my fears go unfounded. Mostly, we discuss details for the funeral, those little things that really seem to matter in the hollow space between a death and the final farewell. I can't bring myself to ask Mom if she's coming, but she seems to want to know the plans, and eventually I realize that I have to assume Robert has agreed to let her come. It's important to Mom that the service is in a church, but I know Annie would have hated that, so I insist we hold it at the funeral home. Mom argues initially, but then just as I decide to give in and give her what she wants, she suddenly acquiesces to my wishes and focuses her attention on the wake. Who will be there? Where will we hold it? Who will bring food? We discuss all of this in far too much depth, and it becomes blatantly obvious that it's simply an unspoken plea from each of us to stay on the line. Something to connect over, after all of these years of polite, infrequent, surface-level chats. Mom eventually tells me that she's flying in the day before the funeral, but the request to pick her up remains unspoken until I offered to send Sam. He's more than happy to oblige. He's been hovering around me looking for ways to support me, and I love him for it. But I can't open up to him about how I'm feeling just yet. He keeps telling me this isn't my fault, and I know he's wrong, but I'm not exactly going to argue the point. As I watch his car leave the driveway to go get Mom, I exhale for the first time in days, grateful for both his assistance and the space. I have prepared Sam for his first meeting with my mother. I've given him a crash course in the customs of the sect, from the long skirt she'll be wearing to her hairstyle and head covering, and the oddly formal way she speaks sometimes, as if 21st century slang has bypassed her village. I've even warned him to turn the radio off before she gets in the car, to avoid an awkward request from Mom to do so. And don't offer her food, I add, just as he's walking out the door. He looks at me blankly. But why not? She can't eat with us. Sam blinks at me. Members of the sect can't eat in the presence of non-believers. I'm not exactly sure how that will work yet. She'll probably eat before or after us. Sam rubs his jaw wearily.
Right. No radio, no food, no profanity, no haircuts. Got it. I waste the hours while I wait for Mom. I bring Daisy into my bed and I lie beside her and stare at her. I've always seen Dad in Annie's daughter, but now I just see Annie. I run my forefinger over Daisy's eyes and her little lips and her cheeks and into her fine hair. I don't know how, Daisy, I whisper, but I'm going to do better for you. When I hear Sam parking the car, I walk down the stairs with Daisy in my arms. Sam leads Mom into the living room, and she pauses when she sees me with the baby. I haven't seen my mother face to face in almost 20 years, and she has aged terribly in that time. Her hair is now white, still straight and long down her back, tucked beneath a dark gray scarf. Her eyes are as red as mine must be. Mom drops her luggage onto the floor and walks stiffly across the room toward me. Her hands shake as she reaches for Daisy, but I pull the baby away from her. She doesn't deserve to hold Annie's child. My nostrils flare as I stare at Mom, but her focus is entirely on Daisy. She reaches to touch Daisy's cheek, and the baby turns her head toward Mom's finger and tries to gum it. Don't waste your energy, Daisy. Mom will never provide sustenance. She is beautiful, Mom chokes, and I let my gaze linger on my mother's face. She wears so many new lines and so many shadows of sadness. How old is she? 64, I calculate, but she looks so much older. I soften suddenly, I don't know why. Maybe it's the tears that roll down over the lines on Mom's face. Maybe it's the reality that I just can't stay angry with her. We have an awful few days to get through, and besides, she is here now. I pass her Daisy, and she sobs noisily as she helps herself to a seat on my couch with the baby in her arms. I watch silently for a while, but then I notice I'm tapping my foot frantically against the floor and I realize how much nervous energy I'm sitting on. Now that my anger is gone, I'm only hurt and deeply saddened that Annie isn't here. If only Mom had come earlier, she could have been. Anger starts to rise again at that thought, and I decide that I need to distract myself. I stand, then walk to the kitchen, and I carefully make tea for all of us, focusing hard on each step. When I'm finally before Mom with the tea, she looks up, and I see the shadow cross her face. I feel like a complete idiot. Didn't I warn Sam about this before he left? Mom can't drink it in the same room as us. It's one of the community's basic tenets, the principle of separation. Sorry, I say, and she shakes her head and draws in a deep breath. No, no, it's okay. Thank you. I really could do with some tea. I look up at Sam. We can leave the room, he suggests. Mom shakes her head again and hesitates for a long moment before she says, Obviously, in coming here, I've relaxed some rules. I think this should be one of them, too. Really? I'm stunned, but Mom looks at me helplessly. Please don't. Just don't mention it to Robert. So we drink the tea together, and it shouldn't be a momentous ritual. But for us, it is. Mom wouldn't have shared food with someone from outside the community in decades. And even as she sips at her tea, she looks slightly nervous, as if the elders might burst in any second and catch her. So to try to ease the awkward atmosphere, I make small talk. How was the flight? I ask her. Good, good. More awkward silence. Then Mom makes an attempt to break it. This house is wonderful. Thank you. And after several rounds of this, the conversation begins to flow a little. But we don't talk about Annie.
and it occurs to me that we haven't discussed her much at all since she died. We've discussed the funeral, but the subject of the beloved sister and daughter we're burying remains somehow still too difficult to address. Sam lingers in the background for a while, occasionally moving into my field of vision. When I meet his eye, he only offers me a reassuring smile. I'm so glad he is here. I smile back, sadly, gratefully. When Daisy starts to fuss, he gently takes her from Mom's arms to put her down for a nap. After he leaves the room, Mom asks hesitantly, "So everything ready for tomorrow?" "Of course it is." I say the words too sharply, and Mom winces. She knew the answer to that question before she asked it. "Besides, of course I've organized the funeral. I've organized everything for the last 20 years. Mom tries now to offer me a sad smile. "At least Daisy is okay?" "Daisy is fine for now. There are a lot of decisions to be made in the next few days." Mom's eyebrows knit together, and then she gives me a critical frown. "Are you and Sam going to..." I rise, and my stomach is churning. "We haven't talked about it." "Well, you look like you're pretty well set up. I'm sure Daisy will be very happy here." Now the urge to snap at her is so strong that I have to wrap my arms around my chest to hold it in. I try to stare her down, just like Annie might have done. I'm incredulous. Does Mom not realize that the obvious alternative to Sam and me raising Daisy would be Daisy's grandmother caring for her? Apparently not. And even if she wanted to, I'd never allow it. Surely she must have considered it. Maybe she even raised the possibility with Robert and he said no. He probably thinks that Daisy is tainted, the dirty, sinful daughter of a filthy, sinful drug addict. "I have things to do," I say, my tone short. "Make yourself at home." I head straight for Sam and Daisy. I find them in the rocking chair in the nursery, Sam completely at home with the baby in his arms. I smile at him sadly from the doorway, and I think about all the dreams that we had. I've imagined him here in this very room, settling a child off to sleep. I just assumed it would be our own.
"Everything okay?"
He asks me the question in a soft whisper. I sigh and shrug. "You know how when someone has hurt you, it takes so little to reopen the wound?" Sam tilts his head toward me, indicating that I should join him. I move toward the rocking chair slowly, then sink down onto the armrest. He slides his arm around my waist, and I lean into him.
"I know your mom has let you down, and there is a lot of history there. But try to keep in mind that she is here. You weren't even sure that she would come, and yet she has. She said in the car that it was very difficult to get away, and I wondered if that meant that her husband didn't want her to come. Maybe it cost your mother to be here. And she has just lost her daughter. This is difficult for all of you, for all of us. But Deborah was Annie's mother. She might not show it, but she must be suffering. She probably thinks that Annie deserved what happened to her. Maybe, maybe not. But she's here, and that counts for something, right?"
On the day of my sister's funeral, I wake at dawn to feed her baby. Then I dress in black from head to toe, a black dress, black tights, and black shoes. I pair it all with a heavy gray overcoat, and then at the last minute, I add a bright pink scarf. Annie always loved bright colors, and it doesn't seem right to forget about that now. I put my hair in a bun and coat it with hairspray so that it is absolutely still and fixed in place. I don't wear makeup. There is no point. I know that I'll cry it off. I survey myself in the mirror and note the puffiness around my eyes and the awful gray bags that now linger beneath them. When Sam wakes, He joins me in the bathroom and he wraps his arms around me and he says,
I love you, Lexi.
I love you too. Daisy, who had been resting in the bouncer on the floor beside my feet, lets out a strange gurgling sound, and I look down at her in alarm. Then I realize the sound could almost have been a laugh. She is staring at the swishing movement of my skirt around my knees, and for some reason, this has her amused. I turn a little, testing the theory, and she makes the sound again, this time achieving something even closer to a giggle. Sam and I crouch simultaneously to stare at her. You picked a weird day to let out your first laugh, kid, I say to her, and I look at Sam. Can you believe that just happened?
Maybe she's giving you a message, Lex, he offers.
I raise my eyebrows even higher. Seriously?
We have to take joy where we find it, even on the worst days. Daisy laughed, which is a perfectly normal thing for an 8-week-old to do. She's hit a milestone, her first milestone, probably right on target. We can celebrate it later, but we need to notice it now. Daisy deserves that, doesn't she?
I swallow, and my eyes fill with the first of the day's tears. I rise and I think about Annie. I would love to be able to call her and say, hey, how is rehab going? Fantastic. Well, you're past halfway done now, and guess what? By the time you come out, Daisy is going to be giggling. She's already trying. And then Annie would say back to me, that's great. That makes all of this worthwhile. I'll keep at it, okay? I bite my lip to try to contain my tears, but I can't catch them. Sam embraces me, and I fight against the urge to give over to helpless sobs. God, if I start now, how am I going to get through the day? It's just so unfair. It's just all so unfair, and it hurts so much that I can't bear it.
You okay?
I nod and straighten away from him. Then I reach for a Kleenex and dry my cheeks. Sam watches me closely as I pick up Daisy and cuddle her close to my face. I breathe in, then out, and then I turn toward the door.
I'm here for you, Lex,
Sam says, and I stop and turn back to him with as much of a smile as I can muster. I know.
Don't forget it, okay?
More tears try to surface, and I nod and hastily leave the room. I walk down the stairs and greet both my mother and my future mother-in-law, Anita, who are in the kitchen working in silence to organize food for the wake. Anita has flown into town to help with Daisy during the service and will stay to assist with the logistics of the wake. Sam has organized all of this directly with his mother, and I'm grateful for that. It means I have completely avoided discussing Annie with Anita so far. I do like my future mother-in-law. She's an elegant, well-mannered woman. But I don't really know her all that well yet, having spent only a handful of weekends and holidays with her over the course of my relationship with Sam. I'm sure that beneath the polite veneer, she must at least be shocked at the chaotic family Sam is choosing to marry into. Now, though, she passes me a piece of toast and offers a sympathetic smile. I murmur my thanks and sit at the table to try to force myself to eat. This day reminds me so much of my father's passing that I have to steel myself against the pain of it. I remember standing on the front lawn and Annie looking so utterly broken that morning and racking my brain to think of a way to bring some magic back into the day. Was it right that I insisted she find some happiness that day? Did that set her on a path of seeking happiness in all the wrong places forever? Now Sam is trying to do the same for me, but life has bruised me so much in the decades since. The last time I wanted to curl up and stop moving forward, Annie was my reason to keep moving. Now that she's gone, do I just stop? Is this the end of me? Or do I transfer that sense of responsibility to her daughter
and repeat this godforsaken cycle all over again. There are so few people at Annie's service. Eliza is there, and other staff from the hospital. This is so depressing. Nobody is here for Annie. They are all here for Sam and me. We make our way to the cemetery, and I watch as they lower my sister's coffin into the ground. The finality of this strikes me, and the crush of grief starts all over again. This time, so intense that I shake from it. Sam's arm is around my shoulders where it's been pretty much all day, but then Mom starts to wail, and he pulls her close too. I would be lost without Sam today. I see the way Mom leans into him just as I do, and I think about Robert. It is utterly evil that he didn't come. He was a cruel man, but he was still effectively Annie's father for many years, and he is Mom's husband. What kind of person is he to be so judgmental that he would even boycott his stepdaughter's funeral? We leave Annie's graveside and drive home in silence to the wake. We eat the food Anita arranged, and people try to find ways to reminisce about Annie. But given how little of her they actually knew, it's pointless. They didn't know her. But I did. She was here, and she mattered, and I loved her. And now she is gone. And maybe I failed her, and maybe the system did too. Maybe if that judge had offered Annie compassion instead of judgment, things might have been different. Maybe if she'd been able to take Daisy to rehab with her, she could have made more progress. Maybe if they'd given her support instead of an arrest warrant, or maybe if she'd been able to go on to a maintenance program instead of into inpatient rehab, or maybe if she only knew how I loved her. All that I'm left with is memories and maybes. How can I build a better life for Daisy when I don't even understand what went wrong with her mother? I slip out of the stilted conversations and resort to sitting by myself in the corner of my living room. Sam sits beside me, and I turn to him and suddenly I'm in shock all over again. This is my fault. Stop, Lexi. Annie was tortured. I don't know why this happened. Who can understand these things? I know one thing for sure. You tried to help her. You did everything you could have done. You were as patient as you could have been. You gave her every opportunity to find her feet, and it didn't work. And it's unfair, and it's brutal. But it's also not your fault. I don't ever want to hear you say that again, okay? I try to take what he says to heart, and sit there silently as the crowd begins to thin out. Finally, I'm left alone in my living room with the small circle of my family, Anita, Mom, Sam, and Daisy. The mom's clean, while Sam and I sit with Daisy. The table is full of half-eaten trays of food, and there are prints on my floor from a dozen muddy feet. And outside, the sky is as gray as the feeling in my heart. Annie is really gone. And somehow, I have to move on. I decide that afternoon that I'm going to keep Daisy. I'm already her legal guardian, I have bonded with her, and I have effectively been her mother anyway. Besides which, there is no alternative. Mom is not offering, and even if she did, I wouldn't take her up on it. The last thing in the world I want is Annie's daughter to live in that same stifling environment that damaged her so badly. I promised Annie that I would never let her daughter near Robert, and I'll honor that promise. But I also decide to keep this decision to myself until I can talk to Sam after Mom is gone. A day passes, and another, and I wait for Mom to announce that she is leaving. But Mom lingers in my life as if she can't tear herself away, and I wish that she and I were close enough for me to ask her what her plans are. Although we're together all day, we don't talk much. Mom changes diapers. She joins me at the doctor's appointments. She even gets up for Daisy in the middle of the night a few times. I have no idea how to interpret her actions, but soon my mom has been in our home for a week. The only concession she makes to her real life back in Winterton is a quick phone call back to Robert each night. She cooks a lot. Baked goods, elaborate dinners, even hot breakfasts some days before Sam leaves for work. It's an odd thing, because I know what a big deal it is for Mom to eat with us. But since that first cup of tea, she hasn't even hesitated about it. Like so many things in my house that week, my curiosity about Mom's relaxed approach to the rules remains unspoken. I want to ask her if things have changed in Winterton since I left, or if she's just adopted a more moderate interpretation of the rules. I can't imagine Robert allowing either possibility. We have never talked about my decision to leave Winterton. I wonder if she understands why I did. Would we get into an argument if I brought it up? I'm still too tender, still looking for places to allocate blame and guilt, and too frightened to dig deeply into anything with Mom in case I shatter our fragile truce. So I don't ask, and she doesn't offer, and instead we share hours of small talk and mutually fuss over the baby. On the one-week anniversary of Annie's funeral, Sam, Mom, and I are sitting around eating lasagna Mom prepared, when she asks without warning, "Will you legally adopt her?" I feel Sam's eyes on my face, and I know that I should say that he and I need to talk about it. But I'm also suddenly terrified that Mom has decided she wants to take Daisy after all. So I clear my throat and I say, "She'll stay with me. I'm already her guardian. Down the road, I'll organize something more formal, an adoption, I guess." Mom nods curtly. Then she leans back in her chair and says, "I'm going to go tomorrow. Robert has booked my flight. I'm needed back at school." "Fine," I say. Mom rises to clear the dishes from the table. Ordinarily, Sam or I would offer to help, but not tonight. Sam stares at me, apparently completely speechless. I open my mouth to defend myself, but he rises abruptly and he raises his hands in disgust, and then leaves the room. I take Mom to the airport. Sam is back at work, and I haven't spoken to him since dinner. He slept in the study again, and I know I'm going to have to talk with him as soon as I get home, and I'm dreading it. Mom picks up on the tension, and as soon as we're in the car, she asks, "Is everything okay with Sam?" "Everything is fine," I lie. "And are you okay?" "No. I'm definitely not okay. My sister is dead, my fiancé is pissed at me, and I'm suddenly a mom." "I'm fine, Mom. Things will go back to normal now, but I'm so glad you could come." Mom offers me a slightly hesitant smile. It was good of Robert to allow me to come." I groan impatiently. "Mom, you know I chose to submit to him, Lexi. It's not always easy walking the path of righteousness." There's no point arguing with her, but now it's awkward again between us. We drive in silence the rest of the way to the airport, but when the time comes for us to say goodbye and she cries as she gives Daisy one last kiss, I actually battle the urge to ask her to stay. I impulsively pull her close for a tense hug, and I struggle to hold back my tears. "Will you come back and see us?" I whisper hoarsely. "I don't know," Mom admits. "I'll ask Robert to pray about it." My arms loosen around her, and I watch as she walks through the gate. I can't tell if you're trying to push me away or if it's just happening automatically and you can't stop yourself, Sam says quietly. I'm sitting on the floor of the nursery, with paint samples on my iPad on the floor in front of me. I look up at Sam, and I swallow hard. I heard him come up the stairs when he walked back in the door from work, and I pretty much froze. I knew a conversation was coming that was going to hurt. I was scared that Mom was going to ask if she and Robert could take Daisy. I just said what I had to make sure she didn't get any ideas. I'm making excuses, and we both know it. Sam exhales.
Lexi, I want to keep Daisy here too. It didn't even cross my mind that we wouldn't. I was going to talk to you about it once the dust settled after the funeral. But can you imagine if I had just announced that I'd decided we were going to do it without consulting you? I should be relieved that we're on the same page, but I'm not. Instead, I'm overcome by guilt. We had this whole life planned out for us, I whisper, and I shrug at him helplessly. How does Daisy fit into that? It's pretty simple, actually. The position in our lives that our first child was going to fill is now already taken, done, plan updated. Sam says wryly, you love that baby, and I love her too. It's a no-brainer. My only bone of contention is my fiancé's nasty habit of making major life decisions without consulting me. There's a serious pattern forming here, and it's making me nervous. I was going to talk to you about it, I say defensively. There just wasn't time. We have to make time for that kind of discussion, Lexi, Sam says impatiently. I'm so sick of hearing you say that. Yes, I work long hours. Well, so do you, normally. We've never had communication problems before. As soon as Annie came back into our lives, you started shutting me out, and I just don't understand why. I haven't shut you out, I say abruptly. That's exactly what you've been doing, Sam says with a slightly incredulous laugh. I can't think of a better term to describe it. You've been through hell, and all along I've been tagging behind trying to support you. Not once in all of this have you asked me for help, or even accepted it without a battle when I offered. I've accepted your help when I've insisted, or you've had no choice. But I... Lexi, can you think of one time in the last 2 months when you've reached out to me voluntarily and asked me for advice or a hug or practical assistance? Just one time. I think back over the weeks that have passed, and in each of the memories that flit past me, Sam is hovering, offering, waiting, agreeing to help when I asked. But he's right. I have asked only when I had no alternative. I didn't mean to, I whisper. I know, Lex. I know it's a habit, and I kind of understand why, but it has to stop now. We're parents now. We need to be a team, right? He stares at me, waiting for my response, and I'm swamped by a sudden realization of how lucky I am to have a man like Sam in my life. I love him in a way that I never expected, with gratitude and with admiration and with a passion that I feel so sure we can cling to even as the years turn into decades. I don't want to undermine any of that at this early stage, just out of a stubborn habit for independence. Right. His serious expression lightens just a little, and he murmurs, you know, with two doctors for parents, that kid is going to be so smart. We're going to need to work together to stay ahead of her. The joke shatters the last of the tense atmosphere between us, and I laugh weakly. Sam points to the paint swatches. We're officially making this a nursery, then? Well, Daisy obviously doesn't want gray walls in her room. I thought maybe a nice crisp yellow would work well. And by that do you mean, Sam, cancel golf on the weekend, we have painting to do? He asks. There's a hint of a smile in his voice. Sam wants to help. Sam is pleased when I ask him to. I'm already learning. I can do this. There are so many things we have to figure out. I only have a few weeks of leave left, so we need to look into a nanny. And I need to talk to someone to see how we go about making this permanent. And we should get Daisy added to our insurance, and... I trail off and groan, suddenly overwhelmed. And we need to paint this room. Make a list, honey. We'll talk about it over dinner. Sam's calm patience is exactly what I need. I tilt my head at him, and I smile.
Thanks, Sam.
See how awesome I am? He says pointedly. And this is precisely why you should talk to me about this stuff.
Got it, I assure him. And this time, I really think I have. A few days later, a police officer comes to my front door. He's holding a small box.
Alexis, you probably don't remember me. I came to the trailer when your sister...
He trails off, and I nod. Can I help you?
We found this in the trailer, and I thought you might want to have it.
What is it? I frown as I take the box.
It's a journal. It was open on the desk when she... We had to take it as evidence in case there was a note. The coroner has closed her case as an accidental death, so we're finished with it now, and I took a look at it and I figured, well, seems like the kind of thing a family member would want.
Accidental? I repeat, and my heart starts to race. How could they know that?
Are you sure you want to know this, ma'am?
The officer asks me hesitantly, but I nod desperately and he says,
well, there were no narcotics in her urine, so the coroner figured she'd been clean for a while and just miscalculated her dose when she relapsed. They subpoenaed her medical records from the hospital, and he said she needed a significant dose of methadone, so most likely she was using a lot of heroin back before she detoxed. His best guess was that she just didn't realize her tolerance would be gone. What was once an ordinary dose to her was this time unfortunately lethal. No way to be sure, but it really did look like a mistake. I'm so sorry for your loss, ma'am.
Thank you, I whisper, and the officer tips his hat toward me and he leaves. I sit by the fire to open the box. When I see the journal, I see the first page filled with Annie's familiar, flowery script, and I start to cry. I touch the page with my fingertip and I trace the words of the first line. Oh, Annie. I start to read, and the tears turn to a smile. As my gaze flies over the words, I hear her voice in my mind, reading it to me, telling me things that she should have told me over all of those years. I read only the first entry before Daisy wakes up, but I'm glad for the break, because I want to prolong this. I feel like this is the last conversation I'll ever have with my sister, and maybe, if I experience this word by word, I can stretch it out until I'm ready to let her go. And despite the officer's assurances that Annie's death was a mistake, I'm still not sure what I'll find on that last page. Perhaps she did make a dosage mistake, but she also relapsed, and she did so right after I hung up on her. Whatever she was looking for in that phone call the day she died, she didn't get it. And perhaps I'll live with that guilt for the rest of my life. But there's a slim chance that some clue to Annie's state of mind is waiting for me in those last few pages. That might not bring me peace. In fact, it might mean even more torment. But if I can just understand her, even a little, then maybe I can let her go. Sam decides to take on the task of finding a nanny, and within a few days he tells me he's found the most overqualified, nurturing woman on earth. She is 33, she has a degree in children's psychology, and she is looking for full-time work. She is happy to live with us, but she is also happy to live separately. If I had drawn up a description of the perfect nanny, a la Mary Poppins, Jane is what I would have described. From the first moment I meet her, I know that we have the right person. I've noticed that some people hold Daisy and other people cuddle her. Jane is definitely a cuddler. She scoops the baby up into her arms with obvious delight, and she immediately launches into a one-sided conversation with Daisy, as if this is a completely natural thing for her to be doing. I still struggle to remember to talk to Daisy, so I marvel at Jane's ease.
Sam asks her about infant nutrition, and Jane teaches us a thing or two about baby-led weaning and the psychology of offering a broad variety of foods once Daisy starts on solids. And don't get me started on reading, she says with a laugh. This is the age to start, believe me. The last family I worked with thought I was insane when I started reading to their newborn twins, but they were eating their words once those kids started school. Jane has a trial morning with Daisy, and I take the opportunity to lock myself away in the study and call Mary Rafferty. It's a task I've been putting off, but now that Sam and I have agreed that we will adopt Daisy, it needs to be done. Oh, Dr. Vidler, Mary says softly when she takes my call. I'm so sorry to hear about Annie. It strikes me that Mary has never used Annie's name like that before. She speaks it with solemnity and care, and I'm actually quite touched. I'm calling because we want to adopt Daisy, and I don't know how to go about it. Well, that's just wonderful to hear, Mary murmurs before she launches into an explanation about the process. We'll need a new lawyer, one who specializes in adoptions. But since we're already caring for Daisy and we've undergone the relevant checks, Mary tells me that the process should be smooth enough. I wish you all the best, Dr. Vidler. I really do, she says when it's time to hang up, and I believe she means it. Jane and Daisy get along just fine during that trial morning. I discuss it with Sam, and we agree that she's perfect, so we offer her the job. Jane moves into the guest house the day before I'm due to go back to work. Everything is in place, and before I know it, I'm dressing in my work clothes and I'm kissing Daisy as I head out the door. I fight a battle against myself as I drive into the clinic. It doesn't seem right that my sister is dead, but that life can still go on as if nothing ever happened. That battle grows fiercer as I force myself to walk through the doors at the clinic. The receptionists greet me with an awkward welcome, careful not to reference what happened, but the sympathy and apology is in their eyes. Even Oliver is gentle with me, offering only a gruff, "It's good to have you back." When I'm alone in my office, tears loom, and I know I'm being ridiculous. This is the job I loved and that I've worked damned hard to get. But I don't want to be back at work. I want to be at home with Daisy. I want to focus on making sure she is okay. I have patients coming, and once the tide of them starts, it doesn't stop. I eat lunch between appointments in the downtime between Mr. Williams's sore elbow joint and Mrs. Thomas's eczema. Sam texts me several times during the day. I tell him I'm fine. I don't want him to worry, and I don't know how to explain why I'm not. Just how much time do I think I'm entitled to for grieving here? When 5 o'clock arrives, I'm exhausted, emotionally and physically, and I cry all the way home. Sam has let me know that he will be late. He is still dealing with a huge backlog of patients and surgeries after these disrupted months, too. I walk through the front door to find Jane, sitting on the lounge while Daisy kicks in the bouncer, cooing happily. And an exhausted kind of anger comes down over me. What is she doing? Jane gives me a confused smile. She's had a great day. The television, Jane, I say sharply. You can't put a baby that age in front of the television. Jane rises and snatches up the remote, then flicks the television off. I'm so sorry. The house was so quiet. The turmoil inside me bursts, but the energy shoots in the wrong direction. I walk briskly toward Daisy and I scoop her up from the bouncer and I say, Look, I don't think this is going to work. If you don't have good enough judgment to realize that a newborn shouldn't be watching television, how can I possibly leave you alone with her? But, Dr. Vidler, I'm sorry, Jane. You should go. She is staring at me in disbelief. And no wonder, this is coming out of nowhere and I'm being completely unreasonable. I know it.
but I also know that I cannot go back to the office tomorrow. I can't pretend to care about my patients when my entire mind is full of grief and loss. Jane tries to convince me to change my mind. Then her pleading turns to irritation, and after she packs up her things, I hear the squeal of her tires as she drives away. I feel so guilty about how I've treated her that I cry again. When Sam comes home, I'm too embarrassed and ashamed to tell him what I did. Jane was perfect, and I'm an idiot. He notices that I'm upset, though.
First day back was tough?
I could tell him that I can't handle this. I could tell him that I need to take some time out from my career to heal and to focus on Daisy. But I can't admit I need to, not even to Sam. I'm strong, and I'm independent, and I'm not the kind of person who unravels. That's who I've always been, and it's how I understand myself. If I could get through Dad's death and Mom's depression, surely I should be able to cope with this. I let Jane go tonight. Sam frowns at me, bewildered.
Let her go?
I fired her. His eyes widen in shock.
What? Why?
I shake my head fiercely. She had this baby in front of the television all day. She all but admitted it. That was her first day, Sam. That would have been her A game. God, who knows where things would have led from here? She has a snooze on the lounge while Daisy rolls around on the floor. What about when Daisy is crawling? She has a little nap and Daisy crawls over to play in the fireplace or the medicine cabinet? No. This isn't going to work. I'll find someone myself, and until then, I'll take some time off work. Sam is staring at me incredulously. There's a pause, and I wait expectantly for his response, knowing he's pissed.
Lexi?
This is ridiculous. Oh, I'm ridiculous now? I gasp, and Sam throws his head back and sighs slowly. I stare at him. But my anger and my frustration are running rampant now, and if there was a chance that I was going to be honest with him, it's lost to my defensiveness.
If you need some more time off, we'll figure it out, Sam says. But let's keep Jane.
We're not going to find anyone else as qualified.
No.
Let's ask Oliver if you can work part-time for a while. Oh, you're going to go in and do that for me too, are you? Lexi! Sam raises his voice and I jump, cringing. He sighs again and rubs his forehead, and then his eyes are pleading with me.
I know you're under a lot of pressure, Lex. I know you have a lot to process. But surely you can see that you're being completely irrational about this.
Now I'm crazy too, am I? You just keep pressuring me. What else do you want from me, Sam? I have to talk to you about everything and go straight back to work and take the nanny you want, whether I like her or not, and oh, I laugh bitterly. And don't be crazy, Lexi. Your family is completely batty, and that's caused enough problems in our perfect little life here, but you can't be crazy, too. Would that be the straw that broke the camel's back, Sam? You can put up with my drug addict sister and my batty mother, but if I'm crazy, too, what happens then, huh? Do you walk out and find someone better?
That's enough.
Sam stands and leaves the room abruptly, and I'm sitting at the kitchen table alone, and all of the nonsense that's just spewed from my mouth circles back through my mind, and I want to suck it all back in. The house is suddenly full of my regret, and it feels immense. The distance to go to Sam and apologize is too large for me to cross. He doesn't sleep in the study this time. He goes all the way out to the guest house. I have a case of confusion-induced insomnia. I pace the halls, thinking about Sam. I reflect on our early days of dating and the giddy heights of our relationship as it progressed. I think about the night he proposed and how I'd never been so happy or so confident about my future. Then I think about how wrong it feels that he's not in our house tonight. And how bewildered I am that I have allowed things to get this bad. It's entirely my fault that he's out there. Even I'm not sure why I don't just march across the yard and drag him back to bed. I am here living the dream and apparently somehow messing it up. But I don't want to rely on Sam. What if I let him take care of me? And what if I get too used to it? And then he decides he can't deal with this situation and he leaves. What if I grew to really need him, and then something happened to him? Would I sink into a depression like Mom? What would that mean for Daisy? In the past, whenever things were chaotic, I stepped into a well-worn groove of being the stable one. I'm the person in any situation who keeps a calm head, who copes and who fixes things. Other people need me. I don't need other people. Why can't Sam respect that? Isn't that the woman he fell in love with? Sam thinks he wants me to rely on him now, but he really doesn't. If I was weak, like Annie, like Mom, God, he'd hate it. It's a burden to be around people like that. I know that all too well. I don't ever want to be a burden to Sam. Maybe that's why I couldn't tell him the truth today about why I fired Jane. I don't want him to know how weak I really feel right now. I make coffee, and I turn the laptop on, and I start to research long-term studies for NAS children. It's better to do something useful than to ruminate on the situation with Sam, even if the studies all say what I already know. There's a slightly increased chance that Daisy will suffer from a hyperactivity disorder. But statistically, the likelihood is that her in-utero exposure to narcotics will have little long-term effect on her health, as long as I can provide her with a stable home environment. Family environment is everything to Daisy now, and her only father figure is sleeping in the guest house because her mother figure keeps pushing him away. My thoughts circle right on back to Sam. I slam the laptop shut and go back to my pacing. Daisy wakes for an early morning feed before I've even gone to bed myself, and I prepare the bottle and sit with her. I stare down at her in the darkness of my room, and she is perfect. She drinks greedily at the formula, and the physician in me notes the strength of her sucking reflex now, and the excellent color in her face, and the increased interaction she has with us. Her eyes light up when she sees me. She is becoming well again. Daisy is now 13 weeks old and has already undergone a detox from a physiological narcotic dependency. It's extraordinary to consider the physical suffering she's endured and how quickly she seems to have left that behind. The worst of her health issues are probably in the past, but then I think about the psychological hurdles ahead of her, and I'm scared again. Every tear she is going to shed, every time she's going to wonder why she wasn't enough for Annie to be well, I'm going to have to walk her through that. Me, the same woman who sobbed all the way home from work today and who can't even admit to her fiancé that she's struggling. I crumple around my newborn niece and I breathe in her scent. She smells of innocence, an innocence that will not last long. How will I ever know what to tell her about Annie? How will I know when she's ready to hear the truth? What do I ask her to call me? If I ask her to call me Aunt Lexi, as soon as she goes to kindergarten, she's going to ask me why she doesn't call me Mom. If she calls me Mom, am I denying my sister's existence? I can't do that. I can't ask that of Daisy. It would be unfair, and I can't ask that of Annie. It would betray her memory. I try to think of a solution right here, right now. I can fix this. Perhaps I acknowledge Annie's existence from the very first moments of Daisy's life. Perhaps I put photos of Annie everywhere, old photos, before she started to look so tired. Come to think of it, those are the only photos I have of her, except that one where she's holding Daisy in the hospital. After a while, I move her into my bed. I cuddle her in my elbow and I keep her at my side, and I stare at her as she sleeps. The responsibility, the complexity, the grief, they are all overwhelming, and they bundle together to create a hard lump in my chest. And I'm facing this alone,
because Sam is in the guest house and I pushed him away. I'm at the kitchen table the next morning when Sam comes in through the door. He offers me a neutral sort of hello before he goes about preparing his breakfast.